And welcome back. Thank you for joining us and sticking with us. And once again, my favorite part of the show, we got a special guest with us, interview. We had him on multiple times and wanted to get him back on to, of course, talk markets, as we always do, but also talk about his new venture that he started that I just signed up for this morning. Plan on being a longtime subscriber, and I am speaking about none other than Mr. Grant Williams. Grant, first of all, how the heck are you? And thank you again for joining us. Always enjoy these chats.
Hi, mate. Likewise. Thanks for having me on again. Yeah, I'm doing well. It's funny. I had a terrible cold all weekend, and first time I've been even remotely sick in a long, long time. And you know, these days it's kind of weird going into the grocery store and putting a shopping basket on the counter that has, you know, Dayquil and NyQuil and tissues and stuff. You feel like some kind of criminal, you know. Everyone's going to look at you as though you've got the COVID. So it was kind of a surreal experience, I have to say.
Well, it's funny you say that, because if I sound now, I do not have a cold, but I sound a little bit hoarse. And that is from, this is what you sound like after sledding in 28 degree weather with an 8 and a 6 year old,
nice.
You know, and the, you know, the yelling and all that kind of stuff. So we had a blast, right? We had a blast, but my voice, unfortunately has paid the price. Well, anyway, big things going down. You've really put the podcast behind the paywall now, and you've launched a new venture. Why don't you kind of walk us through that and you know, what the genesis of it is? Where do you think it's headed? What do you want to do? I noticed when I signed up, we're still waiting for the gold and platinum memberships. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on what that's going to offer. And then, kind of just give us the 411 and let us know how it's laying out and how it came to be.
Well, I think, you know, like, this is something I spent an awful lot of time thinking about, obviously. And it's funny, you know, when you talk about this and those words, you put that behind the paywall, it sounds so dramatic, you know. but the reality was this, you know, I spent a lot of time under lockdown, as we all did, right? Just kind of bored out of my mind. And I started having chats with people, which I, you know, was putting out there and just sharing with everybody. And really, it started as a means to keep myself occupied. And, you know, as they grew and morphed, it turned into a podcast, which again was great fun. I did three separate podcasts kind of under the same banner, with one with Bill Fleckenstein called The End Game, one with Steph Pomboy called The Super Terrific Happy Hour, and one with Ben Hunt called The Narrative Game. And they're all very much different podcasts, but all under that same banner. And the response was tremendous. People really enjoyed the podcast, and you know, I think all four of us really enjoyed doing them. But they, you know, as you know, right, these things aren't straightforward. They take a lot of time. They take a lot of energy to try and put them together. And again, like I've done at other times in my career, I got to the point where I was spending so much time with them, and I figured, look, my time is literally the most precious resource that I have. And if I'm going to commit my time and my energy and my efforts to doing this, then, you know, I'm not doing it to generate a big audience, which is kind of a fairly standard way forward at this point in the cycle. Everybody wants a big audience, and the thought behind it being, if you generate a big audience, then you make yourself attractive for sponsors and advertisers. And I didn't want to go down that road. I don't want to have advertisers and sponsors that I'm beholden to. I would much rather, instead of having 100,000 people listening to my show, I would rather have a much smaller group of people, but a group of people who take value from it, you know. And I think if something is valuable to you, then it has a value, and that value isn't zero. And that aside, I think there are an awful lot of content creators out there now who are up to their necks and swimming in an ocean of free content. And the pushback I've had from a lot of people has been, well, you know, there's so much free content out there. Well, why should I be paying for yours? And I totally understand that. It's a perfectly understandable response. But what I've found in the last number of months is that I've tried to cut down on the free content, and I've tried to focus on the stuff that I really take value from. And I've always been very happy to pay for content that I take value from. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of content creators out there doing great work, creating really important stuff, that have become almost afraid to charge for it because everything else is free. And I think once you let go of this idea that having a massive audience is the most important thing, you realize that having the right audience, no matter what size it is a much more important thing. And so to be able to communicate and create content for people that truly value it is actually a very liberating experience. And it saves you the time and trouble of thinking, well, you know, I wonder if when I put this out, are people going to like it or not? And it also kind of creates pressure on yourself to make sure you maintain the quality of your product to keep those subscribers coming back. So, you know, that's kind of the genesis of it. It took me a long time to kind of think it all through and figure it out. And it's taken me as much time after doing it to answer all the emails I've had from people suggesting that there were other ways I could have gone and telling me what they think I should do and stuff. And look, the vast majority of that came from a good place. I'm not throwing brickbats at anybody, but you know, there were a few people who said, you know, why the hell should I pay for this? And you know, my response to them was, I appreciate that, but if it's not worth you paying for, then it's valueless to you. And so realistically, I'm saving you your valuable time by taking the temptation away to listen to something that has no value to you. So yeah. it's a decision I'm comfortable with. It's a decision I'm happy to see what happens. And so far, the response has been fantastic.
You know, it's funny you brought that up because preparing for this interview, I thought about that exact same thing. And when I heard that you were putting it behind the paywall, I just thought, well, I'll be signing up for that. You know, just you know what I mean. It doesn't even slow me down to pay for stuff that I like. You know, and not only that, but your subscription is extraordinarily reasonable. Whether you go with the entrance level or even the next step up, I mean, you know, it's not like you're extracting a pound of flesh here.
well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, it's just there's a lot of bang for your buck, and you're putting out a lot of good content. And I the thing that caught me that I didn't realize about myself is I sat there and I went, because there's a few other paywalls that I subscribe to as well, and I was kind of surprised by my own reaction, going, you know, I have absolutely zero time. Now there are other things that I listen to that I wouldn't pay for, you know, that I would just, and it isn't out of spite or anything. It's just I don't think it's worth the value. Right. I think yours is. And I have no problem paying for that. The other thing from a guy that does it, the other thing, too, is when this goes from being somewhat of a cash generating, venture, it provides you more latitude and more and enables you to pump more time into it. Does it not?
Yeah, look, it does. But something you said there actually, it I think is very important when you said that there are other things that you listed that you wouldn't pay for. And that, I think, is important because as a creator myself, I don't want to be creating content that people can take or leave. I don't want to be creating content that because it's free, they'll kind of give it a half-hearted listen.
Right.
I want to create meaningful content that has value to people. So there are plenty of people. I mean, obviously, anytime you take something from in front of a paywall to behind it, you're going to lose the vast majority of your audience. The thing is, over time, do you find how many of those people who said, oh, I'm not going to pay for this, over time kind of find out that they're missing the podcast and they kind of think, you know what, it'd be nice to hear what's going on. That's ultimately what I guess anyone that creates content is here to do, to create something that has value for people. And so, you know, like you, I'd subscribe to a whole bunch of things, and I have no problem with paying for stuff that has value for me. But when time is pushed, there's a bunch of stuff that I subscribe to that I'll just delete without reading it. And I don't want to be one of those guys. I want to put the pressure on myself to deliver good content, and I want to be creating something that matters to people.
Well, I've loved them all. I think you're doing a bang up job, and not just because we're talking. I love the guests that you guys have been able to have on. All of them are great. I was shocked to see Singer up there. You know, very very private guy, obviously, and I had no idea. So I hadn't seen a preamble or a warning or a preview that was coming. I just opened the podcast and saw. Wait a second, Paul. They got Paul Singer. I don't think I've ever heard a long form interview with the guy.
Yeah, look, I mean, and we don't publicize these interviews before they come up. except in a couple of very individual cases. And again, it's not any kind of marketing. Bill and I just get on with those, and the same way Steph and I do. We just do the podcast, and when they're ready, we put them out there. And you know, Paul was fantastic. I mean, it was the first time I've had the chance to speak to him, and like you, I hadn't really heard him give a long form interview. And that becomes, again, you know, for Bill and I as hosts, it becomes something that you want Paul to enjoy it. You want Paul to not come away feeling like, it was either a waste of his time, God forbid, or that he didn't either have the time or the latitude to get across the points he wanted to make. And I think that's one of the great benefits of the long form interview is that you can give your guests time to lay out their thoughts. And I think if you're not looking to get everybody's best trade idea, which is, you know, something that I have, it's a real bugbear of mine. I would much rather, while Paul Singer could, I'm sure, have given us a couple of great trade ideas, if we're out there asking him for those, I think you're going to get a very different Paul Singer on the call. I think once he realizes that we're talking in the abstract here and we're talking about ideas, I think you get people much more comfortable in talking about these things. Plus, the value of the information has a much extended shelf life. You know, it's useful and valid for much longer than any moment in time when you want to talk about an individual stock. So, you know, Paul was great, as all our guests have been, and he did enjoy it, and he even told us at the end of it that he'd be happy to come back and do another one. So Bill and I will hold him to that at some point in the future and have him come back.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I think I understand why people want trade ideas, but when you're sitting there talking to somebody like that, I want to hear the philosophy. I want to hear the way that you think of the world, right? There's so much more to that than just throwing off a tip, right? A stock tip.
I'm with you.
Hey, so before we move on, and personally, I just signed up for the introductory because I was really curious about what the gold and platinum memberships were, and I wanted to see that before I naturally upgrade. What is that going to look like? What are you thinking there?
Well, I've got sketched outlines of those. I know what I want to do, but at the moment, COVID is preventing me from doing those things. So they're going to remain under wraps until I've got some kind of runway towards a point in time where I feel like I'll be able to do them. I don't think there's any point in kind of throwing out there what the ideas are until I've got a reasonable expectation that I can deliver them. So those are going to have to remain under wraps for now, Zach, I'm afraid. Sorry, bud.
Well, that's a bummer. But I was just hoping it went something along the lines of the podcast, the newsletter, you know, some Grant Williams socks and t-shirts, you know, that.
Well, you know, I was when the podcast was in front of the paywall, I had a bunch of people email me offering to subscribe, to sponsor the show. And each one of them told me that they had this perfect product for my audience. The highlight of which for me was eco-friendly, biodegradable lingerie, which I think would have been a great fit for my audience. But I politely declined the request.
You know what? That is so good and so random. You might have missed out there, pal.
You know, I may be, but it's a decision I've agonized over. But you know, that ship has sailed, sadly.
Yeah, oh, that's a bummer. Well, you know, the things that could have been, right? okay, so and then, guys, it is really easy. Just go to grantwilliams.com, hit the drop down menu. You've got to subscribe right there. It was really streamlined, really easy. Sign up. And like I said, I'll be waiting. I'm curious to see what the gold and platinum offerings are as well. And I'm if it's like everything else, I'm sure it's going to be worth the dough.
Well, all will be revealed. Although I will just correct you, and it's grant-williams.com. I think there's an NBA player who's a lot more famous than me, and I think if you go there, you'll see pictures of an extremely athletic looking person that isn't me. So it's grant-williams.com.
This tells you how where my focus is. I discovered that. I had no clue there was a Grant Williams in the NBA until I was doing show prep, and that's exactly who came up. And I was sitting there going,
go.
Man, Grant really took this COVID thing seriously. He's looking shredded.
I got in shape.
And your vertical leap has increased dramatically as well, too.
Hell yeah.
Anyway, all right, pal. Well, hey, let's get into this. I've got a whole list of stuff that that I wanted to go over with you. And One of the first things, though, that I wanted to talk to you about was when I, and you know, and I think if people have listened to your show, you know, they know what your perspective is. If they listen to my show, they know that we're pretty simpatico on the way that we see things, maybe some, you know, different fine tuning things here and there. Mm-hmm. But in general, you know, we're looking at this as is a speculative mania slash bubble in multiple different markets and, you know, the everything bubble like you and Jim Stack were talking about. But one of the things that I wanted to pick your brain about, because you've got firsthand experience with, is the analog that I keep going back to. And I think 99 is a very, you know, good analog for what's going on in a lot of different ways. But the one that really interests me is Japan. Mm-hmm. And the reason I really wanted to pick your brain about it is because you and I both know that spectating a market and being in one are two very different things. And you were in that market. You were there. You were in Japan at the time, right? At the peak in 89, weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, yeah, I was.
A couple questions for you, because it's something that I didn't realize until I heard you talk about. I think a lot of us have seen and read The Princess of the Yen and know what the BOJ was doing. But A, I am really unfamiliar with how that drop started, right? How things peaked. Was there any type of pinpricking moment? And then also something else that shocked me was the fact that they continued hiking rates multiple times, despite the fact that the Nikkei dropped 50%. And that was shocking to me, because A, I was unaware of that. And B, I thought, why would they gin up a bubble that big, that long, only to go that hard the other way, especially when it all started falling apart? So first, wanted to just get your insights of what that was, what similarities you see. And because I don't know what your thoughts are, Grant, but I look at that Japanese situation and I really think that I personally haven't seen a better comp or a better situation in my studies that marry up with where we're today. And I just have this nagging feeling that studying the way that that went down really might come in handy. So kind of, if you could just lay out what that was like, what, if there was a pinprick moment or if it just kind of went out with a whimper, and then what the central bank policy, why that drastic U-turn?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I think, interestingly, you've hit the nail on the head there when talking about the rates, because I think that was, it wasn't so much a pinprick, because realistically speaking, if you take yourself back and you look at a chart of the Nikkei, you'll see that it ran up. You know, the 70s was a decade of kind of gentle appreciation, and then as we got into the 80s, the mid 80s, when I started, you know, I started, if you look at a chart of the Nikkei, you'll see that it's very much almost vertical towards the end there. And I got into the market really at the foothills of that vertical summit. But it really was a story of rates. And what was fascinating to me to watch, because I was a young man then. What I felt when I was in the middle of it was all, it felt speculative, it felt crazy, but I was kind of too young and too stupid to really understand it. You know, I paid attention to it and I watched what was going on around me, but I had, you know, zero experience really. So I was kind of guided by the guys around me. What we didn't have in Japan was a crash, you know, and I've spoken about this frequently. We didn't have you know, any kind of, there wasn't one big day where the market just fell out of bed and everyone started panicking. It just wasn't like that. The market went up, it peaked on New Year's Eve 1989, and then it started going down, and it really was that simple. And if you look at a chart, long-term chart, you'll see that it looks pretty sharp from the peak to the trough. But realistically, there weren't any real days where the headlines were screaming, you know, market crash. And I think that's important. But it really was interest rates. And I think why that's important is that I think central bankers learn their lesson from this experience, because Japan, having climbed for 20 odd years, essentially then went down for a couple of decades, more or less. It really fell from the beginning of 1990, more or less relentlessly, for 3 years, until it found a kind of bottom that it could rally from and return to. But as you say, they kept raising rates, and I think that's what's informed a lot of central banks. I think that's why you saw Powell blink when that incremental interest rate made markets fall out of bed in late 2018. They've learned that if they keep doing this, the markets are sensitive and they will end up in this self-reinforcing spiral lower, which could go on for many, many years. So I think that from a policy standpoint, I think that was the lesson that the Nikkei taught people. I think from a market participant standpoint, it reinforces just how important interest rates are, and it makes you realize that the central banks really are kind of trapped and are hostages to the market. If it starts to really crack, that they will be forced to step in and lower rates again, which has really kind of given a big tailwind to investors to stand there and wait for the Fed and the ECB and of course the Bank of Japan to blink. And that's how it's played out. It's been that way. The central banks are in a corner now of their own painting, and they can't really raise rates in any meaningful way, because you will see what we saw in Japan. And I would urge anyone to take a look at the chart of the Nikkei from, I don't know, maybe 1985 through 1992. If you take those 8-9 years, you'll see you could almost put a line in the middle of that chart where the peak was, and it's two completely different charts on either side of that line. You've got the bull run into the peak, and then two or three sharp downdrafts, which play out over multiple months of just grinding lower. And then a steady downdraft, and you can, it's all there in black and white for anyone that looks at it. We've been spared that. Every time we've had that the first sharp downfall, you'll see in the Nikkei, the central banks have come to the rescue and avoided what came next in Japan. And I think it's been an object lesson for everybody.
Do you think it's is simple? Because one of the things I think about our markets is that I kind of see that being the most likely outcome here. I kind of think that you'll just kind of start, and I could be completely wrong, but one of the scenarios I've entertained is that you kind of just start chopping sideways with a downward trajectory, and at some point, for whatever reason, people just quit buying the dip. Is that kind of what happened in Japan? Is you got some turbulence and people, buyers just quit stepping in? It was just kind of a buyer strike and down you went? Was it that simple?
Yeah, I think it really was. The market just stopped going up and started going down, and as it went down, people were kind of forced into selling. The first kind of bounce we saw came reasonably soon in the piece. We probably saw the first bounce, I would think, in sort of late January, but it was a very tepid bounce. It didn't get us anywhere near back to the highs, and then we went kind of straight down for 3 or 4 months. And I think it was that first dip that if you bought it, you were probably at least 30% offside in a couple of months. That was the scare, because after that we had another bounce in mid 1990. But you could almost feel that was seen as that chance to sell. And if I remember rightly, it was kind of we kind of rallied back in the middle of the year, fell again, rallied back one more time, didn't quite make it to that previous rally, and then the bottom fell out. And by the end of that first year of falling, the Nikkei had been cut almost in half. I think it was down about 40% in 1990. And then, it kind of bumbled around at the end of the year, and we had a rally in the beginning of the next year, but that faded, and then we went down again for another year. So I think by mid 92, so 2.5 years, we'd gone from 40,000 down to about 15, I think, in the space of 2.5 years. And so, and if you think about what that must be like from a practitioner standpoint to see a market fall by 2/3 over 2.5 years, it just was relentless. And any dips were any rallies were to be sold. This buy the dip mentality had completely switched around. And that, you know, we're there, but for the grace of central bankers, go we. You know, right now, that's where we're at, right? This buy the dip mentality has been fixed in everybody's mindsets. And so few people have been and actively invested or traded in a sell the rally environment. You know, we had one for a month back in 2018. We had one in the NASDAQ, obviously, after the tech bubble burst. It was definitely a sell the rallies market. But by and large, the central banks have been very activist in trying to avoid that kind of scenario, because I think what was missing in Japan that we have now that would have exacerbated the situation dramatically was the enormous presence of passive investing. You know, if we do turn to a sell the rallies market and we have completely dispassionate passive investment dollars at work that are attuned to that environment, then things could get a lot worse a lot faster. So, and I think the central banks know this. There's a lot of things that we're finding out in the end game they don't know. But I think this is one of them, is that they do realize now that if they let this idea go that they are there to backstop the market and they will step in after a certain amount of pain, then things will come unhinged fairly quickly.
Because, and obviously feel free to disagree, but I cannot see these modern central bankers in general, and the Fed in particular, I can't see them getting religion, right? If they've done everything they have up to this point, I can't see a logical exit point. As a matter of fact, I think that, you know, and you've pointed this out, a lot of people have pointed this out, so nothing breaking. And our buddy Rudy Havenstein reminds us of this pretty much on a daily basis. but the Fed has very much painted themselves into a corner. And I don't see how they're ever going to extricate themselves from this without carnage. And Grant, it looks to me, and obviously could be proven wrong, but it looks to me like they've pushed this so far now that their exiting would become the crisis, right? Just, you know, you wouldn't even need anything else to happen. If they quit stepping in and backing this up, you know, if they just quote unquote normalized, that would be the crisis, wouldn't it? Would it not?
Yeah, look, I think if you remove central banks from this market, then people have to look at the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is very, very simple. The strength of economic growth in the world doesn't justify asset prices, period. It's a very, very simple thing to understand. What does justify asset prices to those that want to find something to justify them with is this ocean of liquidity. I think you're right. I think if they were to exit markets, that would be the trigger for a god-awful crash. So I don't think they can exit them. They would dearly love to, as you say, normalize. But what normalized means today, and what normalized meant, you know, back in the mid-80s before they kind of put themselves on this road to perdition, are two completely different things. And of course, the one thing, and this has been the central theme of those Endgame podcasts, the one thing that is really potentially going to upset the apple cart is any kind of return of inflation. Because that being one half of their twin mandate, their official twin mandate, obviously their third mandate is to support the stock market, but that sensible and controlled inflation that they're supposed to be targeting becomes a real heavy weight around their necks. Because if inflation gets out of control, and out of control where we are now is, you know, 4%, right? That's out of control inflation for where we are now with rates where they are. Then they've got a real problem. And I suspect that this, you know, you'll notice the language very carefully that they've used when talking about allowing inflation to run hot for a while to compensate for all the years it's been below 2%. They don't put a time frame on that. They don't say, well, if we get to above 2%, we'll let it run there for a year. They just say a period of time, which gives them a little bit more latitude. But of course, allowing inflation to go to 3 and then 4 and justifying it by saying, well, you know, we were at 0 for a while and so we're going to average 2 over time, people's mindset changes once it's once they see it go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. They don't expect it to go back down to 3 to 2 to 1 to 0 again. People, you know, we humans are fantastic at extrapolating things. And inflation expectations are every bit as damaging, if not more so perhaps, than inflation itself. Because sometimes inflation expectations can cause problems that, that may not have actually happened were events to take their natural course. And if inflation expectations increase with asset prices where they are now, then, you know, we could see a dramatic upset in the bond market. And the bond market has a long, long way to fall, not just in terms of sovereign debt, which actually paradoxically may go higher under this, but something like high yield, which is, you know, used to be called junk bonds. Now they've changed it euphemistically to high yield, even though it's nothing of the sort. You know, high yield is yielding 4%, give or take, which is, as anyone with any tenure in these markets knows, patently absurd. You know, this whole thing is dancing on a knife edge here. And one misstep by the central banks, and by misstep, what we're really talking about now is not providing abundant liquidity to the markets in any times of stress, could upset the whole apple cart. And if I'm a central banker, I'd be frankly terrified about the potential problems I face and the potential tools I have to deal with them. Because as Janet Yellen said in a speech recently, you know, we have the tools to deal with inflation if it arrives. And my friend Dylan Grice pointed out, we know you have the tools. What we don't know is whether you have the stomach to use them. And that's the important thing, because if they use the tools at their disposal to combat inflation, then they prick this bubble in a disastrous fashion. So that's really what this comes down to now is do we get inflation back? And if we do, what does the Fed do? Because they are on a hiding to nothing.
Well, and the issues, you know, you brought up euphemistically referring it to high yield, you know, and high yield, Grant, it's just so much more woke, you know, it's just nicer, you know, than junk, right? It makes me feel warm and fuzzy to call it high yield, right? I feel like I'm getting more bang for my buck. But the other interesting thing is, when you're looking at that debt scenario, this is a little bit of a U-turn here, but you said something that kind of got my mind going. When you look at that corporate debt scenario, and there's incredible levels of debt everywhere, but when you look at, you know, like you were saying, now we call it high yield, then and everybody starts it, what amazes me is how much of the market signals have been turned off or outright distorted. For instance, I heard some people, I was reading an article about corporate debt, and they were getting into you know, how the market is forward looking, and maybe corporate yields being so low is just the market forward looking. And they were specifically, and the article specifically went into some of the airline companies and cruise ship companies. And, you know, you got the retail traders hopping on those things as trading vehicles. And I got into a debate with a guy on Twitter about Boeing, you know, same thing. You look at these cruise ship companies that have been annihilated. Their enterprise value is the same or as higher as it was in 2019.
Yeah.
And you look at the and so people are sitting there looking at it and going, maybe this is the market being forward looking. And on a rational level, I understand why they're deducing that, right? That's how markets function typically. But if you just take a step back from the ledge and you go, wait a second, these companies are done. I mean, they might not be, right, because of the crazy steps that the government and the central banks have taken to float them. But my whole point, and what I think is a more disturbing problem, is I think the only thing we know for sure from these completely defunct companies having higher enterprise values 16 months ago than they do now is just that market signals are just broken. And the market is not giving you, you know, the information, the price information that it used to in the past.
I think it's a great point. I think what happens now is this: these central bank policies have corrupted the cost of capital, right? And I'm always careful to point out that when you use the word corrupted, you know, that there is a way to use it without it having a certain meaning, but they have corrupted the cost of capital. And so once you do that, once you corrupt the cost of capital, you corrupt every single price signal that is out there, because that is at the very bottom of the pyramid of finance. So I think what happens now is that the market retrofits explanations to explain things that in a normally functioning world would make no sense. You know, junk yields at 4% makes no sense, as you and I know. That's not the correct level for junk yields. The scenario you just outlined in the cruise ships also makes no sense. And so everybody needs a narrative in order to be able to invest, in order to be able to justify things in their own minds, first of all, and then in many cases in the minds of their clients. And so what do you do to justify that? Yes, you can talk about this is forward-looking, because the beautiful thing about the future is that we don't know exactly what it's going to be. So you can use that, and anyone in their own mind can then paint their own scenario and fill in the colors to a future that might justify those valuations. The simple truth is that future, if you are going to find a way to justify these valuations, necessarily has to include central bank policy being exactly the same as it is today, or even more accommodative. Because if it's less accommodative or it's gone away, then that future does not exist, period. So I think that's a big problem here, is that any kind of future you want to imagine, and markets are supposed to be forward-looking, you know, we're all placing bets on the future. The fact that the central banks are so deep in this and so important to this, you cannot take them out of the equation. And if you change their involvement in any kind of negative fashion, and by negative, I mean negative for risk asset prices, i.e. they're tighter or they're less accommodative, then you have to envision a future that is significantly different to the one we have today. And the one we have today is soaring asset prices. So if you want a different environment to soaring asset prices, well, there's only one way you're really going to go, because they're not going to tread water. They're not going to go up here and stay up here and just float gently along. That's just not going to happen. So I think people do need to justify things like junk bond yields, things like the Carnival Cruises of the World raising $4.5 billion in the last 18 months. And the only way to do that is to paint a picture of a future where the economy bounces back, the Fed normalizes, all these things, none of which I suspect is going to come to pass in the way that markets need it to come to pass in order to justify asset prices.
Well, that's the other thing I think is really fascinating, is you see so many of these mental gymnastics done by analysts and investors alike, central bankers as well, to justify what's going on here and try to put a spin on it that's not just central bank dependent, right? And the incredible thing to, or I shouldn't say incredible, I don't want to make it sound like I'm insulting these people. I'm not. I get it. The other thing I think is interesting is you see the people, they gravitate toward the narrative, and you and Ben have talked a lot about this, but they gravitate toward the narrative that benefits them the most, right? They want to believe that it's real, whereas if you just step back, and I think that there's irrefutable evidence that there is, and I think that, the enterprise value of these airliners and these cruise ships is a perfect example, right? There is no economic scenario that's going to last for any period of time that's going to justify their enterprise values being where they should be. I mean, it's just not possible. Go work the math, right? We don't even need to get into, you don't even need to have better than, fifth grade level arithmetic to figure out that that's not going to work. And so I wonder, and this brings me to a question that I wanted to ask you, kind of more on the philosophical bent. And I hate to do that, but again, I feel like, thanks to all of our central banking friends, I think markets, and they've always been this to some degree, but they're as much philosophy as they are finance now, because you're trying to, you're weighting all of these abnormal activities that central banks are taking. And one of the things that I thought about was that in one way or another, if you study the bubbles of the past, maybe they started – maybe there was a moment, a very defined moment where they popped, or maybe they just kind of went the way of Japan and just fizzled. But they all at some point turned into a liquidity crisis. Japan was standing, because I'm not sure that ever developed there. But don't they always turn into somewhat of a liquidity crisis, right? Doesn't that, you know, I think of the all the dot-com companies that were getting money you know, as long as they had that spigot of funds flowing in, right, they could keep running their businesses. But the minute that liquidity was turned off, it was game over. Doesn't it always end up resulting in a liquidity crisis?
Well, you know, the ironic thing is when those spigots get turned off, yes, it turns into a liquidity crisis, but it turns into a liquidity crisis for all the companies who should have gone out of business a long time previously, right? If they didn't. And that's the thing, you know, because the liquidity crisis turns into a solvency crisis. And that's when, you know, Warren Buffett's famous tie goes out and we find out who's been swimming naked thing applies. And so, yes, when the spigots get turned off, it turns into something that looks like a liquidity crisis. But the reality is it turns into reality, right? These companies that immediately suffer liquidity crises in the wake of the central bank spigots being turned off tells you all you need to know. They were unable to survive. And if you look at the number of zombie companies in the S&P 500, you know, these companies that can't service their debt from cash flow from operations, it's I forget what the number is. I lose track of it, but it's in the hundreds. And so we've created an edifice that doesn't work without the Federal Reserve there to prop it up. It's that simple. And we all spend so much time talking about central banks, and it becomes incredibly frustrating and even boring sometimes, because there's nothing we can do about it. They're there and they're going to have to remain there. And the only question is, at what point do they lose the control over markets that they've been able to gain simply by doing the same thing over and over again? And of course, we don't know. But at some point, they are either going to have to throw so much liquidity at this that they trash the currency, or they're not going to be able to throw enough liquidity at it, and risk asset prices fall in spite of them, never mind because of them. And either of those two outcomes is absolutely possible, and I would argue at some point probable. It just happens to not be happening yet, and this outcome has been baked in the cake since they started down this road. Yep. Really in 87 when Greenspan responded to Black Monday by doing what he did with interest rates. We've been on this path now for those 40 years, almost, give or take. And so we've been heading towards a destination. We don't know how long the road is. We don't know when we're going to get there. But it's interesting to see how quickly everything is accelerating now, and COVID has been a tremendous accelerant to this whole process, because what we've seen them do in terms of the multiple trillions that not just the central banks in a monetary sense have thrown at this problem, but now also the government's fiscal response is designed to achieve the same outcome. The speed of this train is really picking up now as we head towards a brick wall at some point. Now the argument would be that, well, you know, if you've been bearish, you've missed out, and look, that's absolutely right. And depending on what your ultimate objective is, but I would argue you could have sat in gold since 2000, you know, a portfolio of 100% gold versus 100% S&P, you'd have done better with the gold.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of fallacy that unless you're invested in stocks, you're missing out, and things are going to go without you, and you know the FOMO thing. It's nonsense, right? Everyone has their own objectives for their investment portfolio, and some people are more risk averse than others, and some people are keen to get in with everything that's moving, whether it's FANG stocks or Bitcoin or whatever it may be, and that's absolutely fine. The trick is really developing a portfolio that suits your own investment needs, and if you're not subject to FOMO, that becomes a lot easier in times like this when you watch, you know, everybody getting rich in GameStop momentarily and, you know, other such short-term instruments. But that reality of normally functioning markets where the cost of capital is set by the market is actually at this point a terrifying prospect, I think, for everybody involved.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the other... The other thing that I find so annoying, oh, if you're bearish, you've missed out on all the run. And look, we've had, I don't say this to brag at all. I mean, I know that there, I know personally of guys that have done much better than this. And to be fair, we really, our value portfolio has had some years of, you know, better than most performance, but, you know, 2019, we were up 9%. Market was up 30, right? So I'm not sitting here trying to say that I'm the second coming of Druckenmiller. But one of the things that irritates me about that line of, oh, if you're a bear, you've missed everything. Our value portfolio now is up 35% since January 1 of 2020. Now, I am bearish. I'm totally sympathetic. You know, I'm right alongside with seeing the world in a much similar, in a very, you can be bearish and still make money and still manage risk. You know what I mean? It's not this all or nothing thing, right? Just because you're bared up and you see a lot of potential bad things out there, it doesn't mean you're not playing around it.
No, that's exactly right. And that's one of these things that, that a lot of people don't think understand necessarily, that you can be cautious, you can be bearish, and just refuse to play in whatever the hot momentum stock sector, whatever it may be at the time. You know, there are plenty of guys out there who are managing client money. You know, good friends of mine who've been in the markets for decades, and they're terrified about the way things could possibly unravel from here. But they still have to invest, and they still have to put clients' money to work in a way that they feel is not just effective but prudent. And I think as a professional money manager, you're prudent probably tops effective. You know, that's something you should always strive for. If you can be effective in a prudent way, that's the holy grail. But if you've got to choose one, then you have to choose being prudent. And so in markets like this, being prudent can lose you clients, unfortunately. You know, I've spoken about this before, but a great friend of mine in Seattle, David Hay, who runs a firm called Evergreen Gavcal up in Bellevue, Washington.
He's about 45 minutes north of me.
Yeah, exactly right. He's in your part of the world. You know, and David's a dear friend of mine and just the most wonderful human being you'll ever get to meet. And he's a tremendous investor and a tremendous steward of his clients' capital. And I've had many, many conversations with David over the years about the importance of doing the right thing for your clients. And David writes a weekly letter called EVA, the Evergreen Virtual Advisor. And it's free. If anyone's not subscribing to it, you should look it up on the internet and subscribe to it. It's a fantastic piece every week. But he wrote a piece a couple of months ago now, which was titled Take Profits. And David's got a really good record of kind of calling tops and calling bottoms. You know, I was actually with him in February, March, when the markets were falling out of bed, and David was buying stocks hand over fist because he had plenty of cash on hand. But he told me that he'd had a lot of pushback on this particular piece called Take Profits. And the pushback was that it was alarmist. And I kind of sat and thought about that. And I said to David, I said, you know, Dave, this is actually the perfect illustration of the world we're in now, because it used to be that take profits was investment advice.
Right.
That's the kind of advice you should be giving your clients. Hey, take profits. You know, you've had a crazy run up, particularly in 2020, given what happened with COVID and everything else, and markets being in a place that nobody thought they would be in the depths of February come the end of the year. But to have people pushing back and saying that take profits sounds alarmist was something that really, really stuck in my head, because that, I think, for me, did such a good job of in one little vignette explaining the mindset of many, many investors today. And I think it's a very dangerous mindset to be in.
Yeah, well, I mean, the old adage, nobody went broke taking profits, right? We just throw that out the window. Okay, so one other thing that I've been thinking about, because and that I wanted to speak directly with you on this topic, was I feel like from probably from 2009 to 2011, we were making money hand over fist in gold markets. So I wasn't nearly as frustrated at that point. And then really probably from like 2012 to 2014, 2015, I could feel myself getting to a place that was not productive, meaning I was enraged at central banks and to a point where it was really distracting me, you know, from doing what I needed to do for clients. And that was a big learning point for me, because I, you know, it doesn't mean that you need to dive in there and go long Tesla and Bitcoin and, you know, all these other things. But, you know, it was just kind of one of those come to Jesus moments with myself where I said, hey, you've got a lot of people relying on you to generate returns in a conservative manner, in a prudent manner. And you cannot get too upset and too frustrated at the inequities that you see, or the degradation of financial markets and centrally bank-controlled financial markets. And so I really tried to exercise the mental discipline to go, quit screaming, you know, from the top of the roof at central banks, and start trying to figure out how this is going to play out, right? Accept the game that is placed in front of you, because it's the only one we've got. And one of the things that I've started thinking about is, you know, I think valuations by and large are insane. But you start thinking about all the things that have been built into, you know, you look at the average P of the S&P going back 200 years, right? It's right around 16. There's a lot of information in that number, right? Well, if you take, and this goes back to what I brought up regarding liquidity crises. If you take liquidity risk off the table, then it seems to me, and again, I don't want to be misunderstood here. I am not trying to make the argument that markets aren't overpriced. I think they're insane. But it does seem to me that if liquidity crises are taken off the table, then you could justify permanently higher valuations, right? That's one less risk you're looking at. And then I want to hear your opinion on that. But I also want to throw myself out there in risk of getting proven that I'm wrong, which I'm totally fine with, Grant. But I look at liquidity crisis in particular and look at what the central banks have been doing and what they are doing. And it seems to me that they are in the unique position to be able to guarantee that, right? That we will not allow liquidity crisis to be a problem. You know, I hear people that I have the utmost respect for, like Bill Fleckenstein, you know, long talking about at some point the bond market's going to take the keys away. Again, from my perspective, the Fed is the bond market at this point. So I'm looking at it and thinking, could the crises that you and I are looking for and that expect and that I, for, you know, from my perspective, see as completely inevitable. One of the things that I'm playing with is, could the crises, right? Could the come to Jesus moment be because markets get so out of control to the upside, so much higher than they currently are, that then that actually forces the Fed's hand? Because they're not going to let a liquidity crisis take it down, are they?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it's an important question for everybody to ponder. And again, you know, we've had this whole melt up scenario being the final phase of this. You know, go back to that chart of Japan, you'll see it. Go back to the chart of the tech boom, you'll see it. The question, I think, when you're in the middle of those runs is yes, we can all see it on the chart after the event, but when you get to the point where you're talking about, well, you know, we still haven't seen the blow off yet, I guarantee you, in the middle of both of those runs, not even the middle, sorry, at the end, there were people still saying, you know what, this thing's just getting started. We're going to see another, you know, 20-30% from here before the thing all falls over. That's just the nature of these things.
Right.
You know, you use the word permanently there, you know, permanently high asset prices. And it, you know, it sends me back to 1929 and Irving Fisher, right? His famous stocks have reached a permanently high plateau. And at the same time, you had Roger Babson, who'd been calling for a crash and it will be quite tremendous. And he'd been early. He'd been calling for that crash for some time. He'd been early for, I think, for 3 years. And people kind of were making fun of him almost. And I think anyone that's trying to predict what's going to happen to these markets, there's an old saying that being early is the same as being wrong, and it's absolutely correct. But as I said, if we think that this market is going to have another blow off, do you have to be in equities in order to capitalize on that? I don't think you do, because I think if we go from here, it's hard to see the bond market having a raging bull market from here. Simply in absolute levels, it's very tough to see how it would do that, considering where they are. Yes, junk bond yields could go to zero. Maybe all bond yields converge at zero. Maybe that's in the future. Who knows? But if we're in that world, then I suspect it will be for exactly the reasons you laid out, that it will be this ocean of liquidity, being thrown at markets. And if we have that kind of liquidity being thrown at markets, it will really only be happening because the economy is in such poor state that without that liquidity, reality would assert itself. And so I can only imagine that the pressure valve for all of this, if those conditions that we've just painted were to take place, would be the currency. And if we are seeing this kind of liquidity, you are going to see currencies under significant pressure, not just the dollar, but the euro and the pound and every country that is kind of participating in this kind of frenzy towards the end. And really the only thing they can all devalue against, some would say Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is as yet untested. I think we're seeing some of that now. I think that's part of the reason why Bitcoin's doing what it's doing. But real assets, you know, gold and silver particularly, monetary assets, but also real estate, but also commodities. And that, to me, is by far perhaps the most interesting place for investors to be looking right now, at the commodities space and the commodities producers. But that ocean of liquidity is going to have to be reflected somewhere, because we all know we can't just go on printing this money forever. And I think the only place left for it really to be reflected in is going to be the currency. And that leads to a crisis all of its own, unfortunately.
Yeah, you hit on a couple things there, and I want to circle back. But one of the things that I find fascinating about bubbles in general, and this one in particular, is how the average people are so willing to accept that narrative, even though they've seen it break down countless times, right? Like, for instance, you know, I'll pick on two here. And before I get spammed with Bitcoiners and hodlers, right? I own some. Okay, so I'm not.
Leave the guy alone.
Right. I understand the efficacy of it, and I like it. I don't think central banks will allow it to win. You know, but anyway, don't want to get into that. But have we ever seen a financial cycle where you get performance like we've seen, and bubbly, frothy conditions, you know, like we've seen, where the real winners that come out of that are the things that the youngest and most inexperienced investors are the most loaded up on, right? Like, we're all willing to set aside our disbelief for Bitcoin and Tesla and the like, and so many of these SPACs and the green energies, and we're going to Mars and space and all this kind of stuff, right? And one of the things that I think is incredible is that people act like, you know, for lack of a better term, this time is different. And I just sit there and I think, where have we ever seen a period of speculation like this, where the epicenter of the disaster, right, wasn't the stuff that the youngest, most inexperienced investors were loaded up on, right? Isn't the fact that you know, the fact that so many young people are into the green energy type stuff and the plug powers and Bitcoin, I mean, isn't that just, you know, and again, I know that there's some smart people who are riding right along with that, but right, isn't that always the case? Isn't that always the telltale sign that's the epicenter of what's about ready to blow up?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, it's the nature of the investment business that, you know, it's always those who have the shallowest knowledge and end up being the last ones into the pool. And of course, that makes sense, right? Because any of these stories is an ongoing process. And the sooner you understand the story and the more research you do about the story, the earlier you get into it and the lower down on the price ladder you get. When it becomes, you know, the famous Joseph Kennedy shoeshine boy, you know, giving him stock tips. When you get to that point where stocks are really just a tip, like we've seen, you know, GameStop was a perfect example of that recently. And we're now starting to see the stories trickle through about all the people who just went and borrowed money and bought GameStop because everyone was talking about how it was going up. The perfect example of being late to the story, not really researching it, but just hearing, oh, well, these things always go up. It happens every time. It happened in 99. It happened in Japan in the 80s. It happened in 29. It's always the same, and it's perfectly explicable, right? There's no confusion about why things go down that way. And you can see it now, right? You can see when you look around all the anecdotal stories about, you know, such and such a guy's nan has been asking whether she should buy GameStop calls. And oh, and by the way, what's a call? You know, it's those kind of questions that tell you that people are being sucked into the market by the lure of easy money. And, you know, another conversation I had recently with Tony Deaton on a podcast, and Tony was talking about this man's fascination with earning riches without having to work for them. And man does have a fascination with trying to find new and interesting ways to become rich without working. It's as old as the hills. And so whenever you get presented with, oh, you know, Bitcoin only goes up, you know, this number go up, and all these crazy three-word memes that the Bitcoiners are pushing out there quite aggressively to try and get into people's heads. What we haven't seen before, I don't think, which is an accelerant to this, is we are living in an age of meme culture now that is fueled by social media. And so distributing these memes and sucking people in at the fringes to these crazy rocket-fueled rides at the end has become very, very easy and very, very dangerous. I suspect when all said and done, GameStop is going to be the perfect example of this, and far from the Main Street sticking it to Wall Street narrative that it began as, I think when the dust settles and you're starting to see the stories come out, and I'm actually writing about it now for my February letter, which is out next week, it's not going to be anything that it was first thought to be. And in fact, the people who made the money are going to be the Wall Streeters who understand how the game works. And the people that ended up losing the most money, apart from, you know, a few people who got in on the ground floor on the Wall Street bets side of things, are going to be poor retail investors that didn't know what they were buying, didn't know how the system worked, didn't understand the rules, and ended up being cleaned out. And it's incredibly unfortunate, and it's a horrible thing to see. But that's the nature of playing a game with incredibly complex rules, coming late to it when everybody else is already on the pitch and expecting a level playing field. It just doesn't work that way, unfortunately. There's a huge information arbitrage here. There's a huge arbitrage on how the rules of the game work, you know, particularly when we saw that, you know, the Robin Hood, for example, the margin call that Robin Hood got and the fact that they had to stop trading. Well, that didn't stop the Wall Street guys trading. They could absolutely sell their shares, even though the Robin Hood guys couldn't. And that outage on Robin Hood's part was perfectly predictable if you understood the rules of the game. You realized that given the trading activity frenzy that we'd seen in the days running up to it, there was going to be a margin call for Robin Hood. Anyone that understands finance could see that coming a mile off. But, of course, that's not something that you understand. And so we had this narrative being pushed around that they changed the rules in the game and what Robin Hood had done was evil. The only evil thing they did was the CEO going on CNBC and lying about his margin call, you know, which used to be called securities fraud, but it isn't anymore, apparently. So what you described, that retail frenzy, is always the end of a bubble. What we don't know is just how long that phase goes on for. It feels as though this phase has really just got started, but I suspect because of the run-up we've seen prior to this phase commencing and the speed with which these bubbles now inflate and burst, this retail frenzied speculation part of the bubble may actually be shorter and more spectacular than ones we've seen before, which begs the question, are we there yet, for want of a less commonplace phrase?
You know... And I was introduced to the term, what did the kid call it on Twitter this weekend, where he said that's an undercover flex, and I was sitting there going, what does this guy mean? Something I said. Anyway, I don't mean to be flexing at all on this one. I really want to lay out the story. You brought up GameStop, and if you guys want to, you know, if people want to hear my stories of trades that haven't worked out, I got a long list of those too. So in no way am I.
And we all have.
Yeah,
all
have. Yeah, no way. But GameStop was really, I didn't even have that in my notes to talk about, but you brought it up. So GameStop was really fascinating to me because, again, I knew going into this whole, you know, I've been thinking that these things were pretty crazy. This market was pretty detached for the last 3-4 years, really. And so it didn't surprise me, but it showed me Well, I'll explain the story. So we'd been watching GameStop since 2015. One of the things I like to do is track guys that I respect and look at 13Fs when they came out. And I saw GameStop in Michael Burry's 13F.
Yep.
And it was because I had been burned before so many times on value plays like that, that I put it on our list of what we call value with a catalyst. So things that we think are really cheap that have potential, but we need to see a catalyst to move the business forward.
Right.
And as soon as Ryan Cohen took his position in GameStop, we initiated a position in October of last year, right around a $12 a share level. And the short squeeze was part of our thesis. And we had done a lot of work on it, Grant. And I thought that as the business was currently constructed, a $20 to $25 share price on it was pretty rosy and would show a lot of optimism about what was going on.
Right.
And when it started squeezing, we also knew that we thought it would overshoot that level because of the short interest on it. And the flip side again, and if people that have listened to me before, I'm not going to go ranting on this. I think one of the most incredible things about that story that's not talked about is the lack of risk management going on with the hedge funds with this. I thought that thing looked like a powder keg. And we let it run and we got up to $42, $43 a share. And I just said, okay, this is insane. There's no way I'd pay this much for this business. And we cashed out. And then we 10X'd from there, right? So,
right, right. Yeah.
You know, and I watched that and I bring that up because, A, you know, we made 340% on that trade, I want to say, in something like, you know, 2.5 months. So I'm not griping. But it gave us a front seat to how insane this market's getting. You know, and to the point where I had an interview with Yahoo Finance on this topic. And they asked me, so what do you think? You know, do you think there's room left to run in these things? And at the time, I think GameStop was $150 or $200. And I looked at them like, are you kidding me? No, there's, you know, this thing is off the bloody map. But seeing that up close, having done so much work on the name, and I'm not going to lie to you, it felt like getting a stick in the eye. You sell the thing at 42, thinking you're being prudent and watching it 10X over the next, you know, 7 trading days that, you know, that felt like a kick in the guts. But then again, you know, we never go broke taking profits. But having done that and watching that thing, you know, it goes to what you and I were talking about, just that full realization, you know, irrefutable proof that this market is not running on economic reality at all, right? Nobody cares. It's just floating out there in the ether. And you know, it's almost like we redefine the rules of what these asset prices can do on a daily basis. You know, it's just turned into a game of fun flows, which, you know, Mike Green has done a ton of work on. But yeah, watching that up front was just, or front and center from our perspective was just fascinating because you just, you know, people were getting involved at 115, 150, $200 a share.
I think this is such a good thing to talk about because I think there's so many lessons in here, not just for retail investors, but for professional money managers too, right? And as I said, this stuff is in my head because I'm in the middle of writing a piece about it. But if we go back to the 28th of January, right, and I want to run you through the day that GameStop had on the 28th of January. Now, the stock opened at $265, which was actually down from, I think it closed at 310 the day before, right? That's already a big enough move. From 265, in the next 2.5 hours, it traded at 483 and 112.50. Right? In the next 2 hours. So 265 open, 483 high, 112.50 close low, and it closed at $200. So the net change on the day was down 30%. Right? But it during the day, it basically closed 25% off its open, 60% off its high, and 75% off its low. Now, that is an untradeable stock for anybody who is a professional money manager. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about what it felt like to make 340% and then feel like you're getting kicked in the teeth, because I'm sure when you sat down and thought about it, you realized there is absolutely no way with any prudent risk management that you would have ever held onto that stock to 483. No way, right?
100%. Absolutely.
So we all know that. But still, the emotional side of the game, the emotional component of this, which is so important, you know, people don't understand that every chart that you ever look at is just the collective representation of the emotions of everybody involved in that market. That's it. Yeah. That's all it is. And so for the retail traders to see that, to see what can happen, there are lessons to take away from that. Just that one day. The unfortunate thing is those lessons, they won't take away, because no one's going to look at this and think, wow, I could have held on to something that went from 483 to 112.50. If that happened, the chances are you're one of the people that bought it at 483 and 2 hours later were staring at it at 112.50 and wondering why the hell you'd lost three quarters of your money. It's not a lesson that you learn, because you get scared out of the stock market. You either hang on to it, hoping you'll get your money back, which normally is the road to ruin, or you can't take the pain, you dump it, and you never go near the stock market again. Now, for professional investors, there are all kinds of lessons here in risk management, right? What's the right thing to do when you buy a stock at 12 with an investment case and it clears your $25 hurdle? Well, the right thing to do is what you thought you'd do, which is close out the position, unless there's been a material change in your investment case that suggests that you ought to run the position or trim it or you know, adjust it rather than closing it out. And that's what professionals do. They evaluate the situation. They don't just say, well, this thing's running now, so I'm going to run with it. They'll either take some off the table, they'll move their stops up. There are plenty of things you can do to ensure that you don't print at 483 and end up holding this thing still at 112.50. But unfortunately, the lessons come from experience. You know, it's like having kids. I've spent the last 30 years trying desperately to stop my kids from experiencing bad outcomes and things. And you warn them and you warn them and you warn them about, you know, courses of action to take under certain situations. But pretty soon as a parent, you realize, you know, they have to learn this through experience. They're not going to take my word for this and not do that. They have to touch the stove. And they have to burn their fingers. It's the only way that this lesson's going to go in. And unfortunately, with the stock market, that's what it does. It deals out lessons to professionals and amateurs alike. The difference is the professional lessons tend to get less painful over time, because you hope you've learned the really painful ones the hard way. And for retail investors, the painful ones either scare them away from the market, or they make them do something incredibly foolish, which is assume that, you know, GameStop got to 483, so there's no reason it won't get there again. Because you and I both know there are a million reasons why it'll never get there again.
Yeah. Don't hold your breath, right? It was, and you know, going back to it, and I say 42, I'm actually, this is how out of control it was. I told our trader, I'm taking a little too much credit for that. I actually told our trader, our target on it was 35. To me, that was the upside limit. I was like, if we hit 35 in this squeeze, we're getting out. We cleared 35, went right to 36. I told him to put through the trade. By the time the trade cleared at 42 and change. Yeah. So I've said 42 because that is where it went. I was intending to sell it at 35. So, but I was telling the guys in our office too, they were like, oh, are you bummed out? And I was like, look, it feels like a kick in the gut to watch it go that high and not participate. Having said that, run me through that scenario 100 times and I'm going to do the exact same thing again.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I think that's the difference between professional investors and amateur/retail investors. And a good friend of mine called Lee Robinson said this to me once. I asked him that question point blank. I said, explain to me how you view the difference between professional investors and retailer. And he said something so simple and yet so profound. He said, professional investors know how and when to sell. Mm. And that is the absolute perfect way to frame it. You know when to sell. You know when to sell on the upside, which is what you did. And you know when to sell on the downside, which is risk management. Yep. And the fact that you didn't hold on to 483 is not a black mark against you. You did the right thing. No, you sold it at the right time. But it's hard not to get sucked into that, right? Because anyone that bought it at 300, saw it up to 483, bought it at 483 thinking, here we're going to go, we're going through 500, sees it at 400, a professional is going to say, you know what, I've missed this. I need to cut my losses, hopefully before it gets to 400. But the amateur is not going to sell and take that loss. The amateur is going to say, if I hold on long enough, it'll get back there again. And as you and I know, there is absolutely no guarantee, particularly with something that's done what GameStop had done at that point in time, that it will get back there again, just to zero.
I mean, if you do a 1-for-10 reverse split, you might be able to get there. Well, the other thing that was funny to me, Grant, was watching the outrage and listening to the people on CNBC scoffingly go, this thing isn't worth it. And I want to say at $450 a share, it was trading at like 6x revenue. I understand that Tesla is a better company in terms of growth prospects. And I'm not saying it's equivalent, but Tesla manufactures durable consumer goods, right? The baseline.
Well, not so durable in some cases. But.
Well, yeah. Not so durable. Right. How do you justify, you know, these same people sitting here going, this is outrageous that GameStop is valued this high, which it was. I mean, it was obscene. Tesla's is no less obscene at 32x sales, I think is where we're at, or 30x sales,
yeah.
Right? And it's 7x this year based on what? And so that's the other thing that's fascinated me is looking at this market and the selective outrage. It's a lot like our culture, I guess you could say, right? There's a lot of mirroring going on there, which is, you know, it kind of reminds me of the old sardine story. You know, it's oh, no, you don't have to. Those are trading sardines. Those aren't eating sardines, right? Where it's we're making these judgments between, well, Tesla's a different case. And I'm sitting there going, why? Wait, well, why is that, right? Why is what GameStop just did, is that obscene? And yet what Tesla did, you're celebrating it, right?
I've thought about this a lot, and I've written about Tesla a lot, and I'm, you know, my feelings on Tesla as a company, as a stock, are pretty widely known. But I think the difference, and again, it comes back to the difference between in perception. When you're talking about the price to sales ratio, the price to revenue ratio, you're talking about things that the majority of people who've been buying Tesla that last year have no idea what you're talking about. You could be talking a foreign language to them. They see a story. They see more Teslas in their neighborhood than they saw before. They see their friends talking about the stock, and they buy it. And it's been enough to run it up. This again, powered by the meme culture and powered by this kind of this wave of retail money going into it, buying a few shares here and there. Look, it's been remarkable. It really has to watch. But again, this is another problem of allowing economic reality to reassert itself for the central banks. If they step away from this now, what price Tesla? You know, if you remove the corruption of the cost of capital, where does Tesla trade relative to Toyota, relative to Daimler, relative to Audi, relative to, you know, GM? Any of these car companies that sell multiple more cars are profitable, and in most cases are moving into the electric vehicle space. You know, there are some tremendous pairs trades there to put on when the time is right, because Tesla is going to have to fall a dramatic amount to reflect reality, or the other ones are going to have to rise. And on the basis that car sales are fairly stagnant with a fairly predictable increase in up years and a fairly predictable decrease in down years, it's not going to be the legacy car makers tripling, quadrupling in price that's going to kind of close this gap. But the time to do it is not now. And a lot of people have been burned being short Tesla. You know, and that's another part. We talk about the culture. This whole Tesla Q movement that kind of sprung up around the crazy valuations in Tesla and some of the behavior of the CEO and the quality of the cars and all this stuff. The narrative amongst the retail investors against that has been, the shorts have, you've stuck it to the shorts and all the Tesla Q guys have lost a load of money. The vast majority of them are professional investors. Some of them, while despising the company and the CEO, have made money on the long side from being long calls, right? There's a way to separate any anger and any beliefs about something and put money, making money ahead of it. Other people have managed their positions and they've lost a bit of money, but to think that every short has been short Tesla in single digits and still holds that short at 800 is crazy. But that's just the misunderstanding of how the game works coming home to roost again. You know, I've spoken to plenty of people in the sort of Tesla Q community, many of whom have lost money, most of whom have not lost a life-changing amount of money because they had risk management and they realized after a point in time that this is a fight that I'm going to have to fight another day. Now is not the time to take on this bear. And so, you know, there's always a disconnect between the narrative and the reality. And what I've noticed more and more in many aspects of the kind of financial landscape is the difference in the narrative and the reality, and the fervor with which narratives are created around just about anything these days. Because I think we all realize now that if you can create a narrative around something, it's that much more accessible for that many more people, and that's how you can drive things both up and down. Let's be realistic about it. On the short side too, it's just the short side has a much harder time gaining traction simply because human nature is tougher to convince to the short side than it is to the long side.
It's funny you bring that up because that is exactly something that I have struggled with at great length during this cycle. Is that the power of the narrative. And naturally, probably due to the fact that I grew up this way, I grew up in a brokerage firm, you know, and so even though it wasn't me pulling the trigger, you know, I've said before, I was five or 6 years old when it happened, but I remember to this day, I remember the look on my dad's face when he came home on Black Monday in 87. You know, you're closer to these things. So even though it wasn't you pulling the trigger, it leaves scar tissue, right? So I think being around that, Black Monday, and then in the mid to late 80s, they were doing extensive work on the VC side funding startup gold mining operations. So as you can imagine, that was quite a dry run there. There were a lot of bad investment outcomes during that 5, 6, 7 year stretch of my dad's career. So I got to see a lot of those downsides right up front. And one of the things I've struggled about in this market, Grant, is I'm a guy that really has never paid much attention to narrative. I feel like there's always a lot of misinformation in narratives, and I look past them. One of the things I've had to start doing in the last 2 years is sticking to the way that we're managing risk and even bolstering the way that we're managing risk, but forcing myself to pay attention to more of the narrative because it's unbelievable. And again, I ran through the financial crisis, but, you know, people, what was the PE ratio of the S&P at the height in 2007? I think it was only like 15.8 or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
It wasn't nearly as out. I mean, not even close. So this is the first mania that I've personally navigated in my career. And the narrative is almost the only thing that matters. It's almost like the less narrative, the more substance you have. Like that's a handicap, you know. If your reasons to buy, you know, if you're a CEO and the story you're telling the public is that, look, we've got solid growth, we've got a conservative management team that's been really good at balancing or managing our balance sheet, and we've increased margins and cash flows look good, you might as well not even waste your time, right? Nobody's interested in that.
Yeah.
And the narrative has become all that matters. Right, I mean that is the story.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Look, I have to give shout outs to two guys in particular who've helped me understand that. Ben Hunt being one of them. Ben's really helped me understand, which is why I wanted to do the Narrative Game podcast. Ben's really helped me understand not just the power of narrative, but how they're created and why they're created. And another friend of mine, Roger Mitchell, with whom I do a sports podcast called Are You Not Entertained. Roger has been all over this, and he's been talking to me about the power of meme culture, and I struggled to listen to him initially, but as it's gone on, I've realized that he's absolutely right, and this meme culture is so important now, and it's so important to understand how it works and the effect it has. So he's really educated me in terms of putting aside my Gen X kind of biases and embracing the kind of the way that the millennials and Gen Zs look at this thing and how important meme culture is to them. And it's kind of all come together. The narrative and meme culture worlds have all come together in this recent Wall Street Bets story, you know, with GameStop. And it kind of started with Hertz. You know, you could see how that was happening, even though, again, to any seasoned financial practitioner, you realize what was going to happen. But knowing what's going to happen ultimately and understanding why something's happening in the moment are both distinct but equally important to try and understand. And for me, that gaining that understanding of meme culture has been hugely beneficial in being able to look at the Hertz situation, for example, and not just pile in and short every share I could against it way too low, because you realize that once these things have a meme attached to them and have a tailwind behind them, you realize that they can go a long way. I think it's easier for us as market practitioners to recognize when that meme's worn off. You know, the recent move in the silver market was pretty obvious, I think, to anyone who's been actively trading silver for the last 20 years, as I have. You could see the right time to sell into that Wall Street Bets inspired silver rally, because you knew where the pressure points were, you knew where it started to get dangerous, to let it get out of control, and you could feel the strength of the meme dissipating, because having seen GameStop run up, I don't know how many thousands of percent, 15,000% was it at one point?
Something like that.
The fact that silver was relatively disappointing, if silver had doubled, it would have been disappointing. You realize that when you see how these memes work. And so I think if you pay attention, it becomes much easier to figure out, okay, what's the next step in this process? And I think that's a great tool to add to your arsenal.
Yeah, it's been a tough one for me, because it's not the way that my brain works. I'm a skeptic, you know, and it's just hard for me to get on board. Okay, so we've been going on for a while, and I know you're a busy man, and I appreciate the time that you've given. So there's two things that I wanted to hit on before we ended this that we haven't had a chance to get to. And one of them is listening to the recent podcast that you did with Jim Stack. You guys were talking about the different asset classes and bubbles. And we got off track because I wanted to loop this in to the part of our conversation where we were talking about the distortions that the Federal Reserve has made. And if you're providing constant liquidity, you know, should valuations be higher? And the thing I wanted to work into that was, after listening to that podcast you did with Mr. Stack, which I fascinating guy to listen to. And I love people that can break down complex things in simple terms. And, you know, to me, that's really the test of knowledge, right? Whether you can explain it to a 5-year-old. And I just thought he's so concise and on the money. I really enjoyed listening to him. But real estate, the topic of real estate came up, and I thought this was a perfect example of what I was saying earlier about the Fed distorting these things. And I recently refied my house. I bought my house that I'm living in, bought it in 2010. I wish I could tell you it's because I thought real estate was going to go through the roof.
Right.
That I did not at the time. I simply did a classic value investor play where I was like, well, it's a much better to buy. It's much better time to buy than it was 2.5 years ago. And so that was the premise. But I recently did a refi, and I was shocked to realize that my house was up something like 120% since I bought it. And the reason that struck me is because I wouldn't pay the price for that house.
Right, right. Yeah.
And Grant, there's some emotional attachment. All three of my children were born in that house, right?
Yeah.
I'm looking at it and going, this is insane. Having said that, I did some work on this. And if you look back to 2007, and the point that I want to make here is I don't want to disagree. I look at the housing sector and I think this is insane. This can't. But to me, this is a classic example of the distortions and how hard it is to get to the truth with what central bankers have done. If you look at the median sale home price in the United States in 2007, you were running right at $340,000. That was the median home price. $309,000 in 2007. as of today, or in January of 2021, so at some point in the last 30 days, median home price in the United States is $340,000. Okay, now, sure, it's higher, and people would go, look, that was the biggest real estate mania in history, and we're a good 10% above that now. But there is a glaring difference here. The average 30-year U.S. mortgage in 2007 was at 6.34, mm-hmm. right? Today, you're at 2.6, 2.7?
Yeah.
Right, so if you normalize 2021 to the average mortgage rate in 2007, it puts you around a $200,000 home price. And the reason that that's giving me real pause and making me scratch my head is nobody in the United States buys a house anymore. They buy a mortgage. And they're just looking at that monthly payment. And then when I look at places like, do you know Andreas Steno Larsson? Do you know?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So he was telling me, and I don't want to talk out of school here because I could have the numbers slightly off, but he bought a place in Copenhagen not too long ago. And I believe he told me he got it financed at negative 0.35.
Okay.
What I'm sitting there looking at, Grant, is going, oh, why isn't the Fed going to end up there? Why aren't they just, if they've taken us this far down the trail, and especially if the stock market gets wobbly, I feel like they would just dedicate even more attention to real estate and just keep buying up mortgage-backed securities and pushing mortgage rates lower. And if they push mortgage rates lower, housing prices are going to continue to go up.
You're right. I think at a certain point in time, the Fed was taking us down the trail. I think at this point, the trail is dragging the Fed down it.
Right.
I think that's where we're at, and they are on that same glide path. The problem comes with if you're propping asset prices up and you're dragging everybody into cheap mortgages and you achieve that, if the cost of capital goes up or we have inflation, if God forbid the 10 million people who've lost their jobs in the United States don't get them back, then the more people who have mortgages, the more potential defaults there are. And so you get to that point in the cycle where, okay, well, we've all got these mortgages now. We saw what happened in 08. What are you going to do? I mean, Fed, government, someone needs to come to the rescue here, and someone needs to start making mortgage payments because you've covered everything else. And hey, how about you forget Wall Street for once, and how about you save the man in the street? Right? This is where we're going. Mm-hmm. We're going to this point where the government and the Fed are seen as the savior for every kind of financial ailment. And that's perfectly understandable because they have essentially in the last 35 years set themselves up as exactly that by reinforcing the idea that whenever there is financial turmoil, one or the other or both will step in and come to the rescue. And it's very difficult to break that. It's very difficult to tell people, actually, we can't do that anymore, particularly on the political side. It's tough to tell people you want to vote for you that you're going to be the guy who says no to them. So they won't say no. They will keep doing this. They will keep sending stimulus checks out. They will keep lowering interest rates. They will keep buying bonds. They will keep doing all these things. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I suspect it's gonna play itself out with yield curve control, which is almost guaranteed to be essential at some point in time because there are levels of average interest payment that just don't work for the US government, for example. You are going to see all kinds of capital controls, not through choice, but at some point they're going to be necessary. All these things are going to be necessary to stop a flight from the dollar, for example. I don't know when those things are going to happen, but when you talked about us being on the same glide path, that's exactly where we are. We are on that glide path, and that glide path, ultimately, when you're on a glide path, it leads to the runway, it leads to the ground. And this glide path is the same. It leads to all these things unless we get a miraculous burst of organic economic growth from somewhere. And we get 2.9% steady inflation that allows them to inflate some of the debts away. You know, there are scenarios you can see where this plays out over time and they can ease their way out of it. But We used to call them green shoots. I think then we called them Goldilocks. I think these are now fully fledged unicorn scenarios that any right thinking investor should really not give much credence to.
Yeah, no, it seems absolutely ridiculous to think of a smooth landing at this point. It's just right alongside the whole. What wasn't the projection that we'll normalize? I want to say it was like by maybe it was 2013, 2015. Bernanke this was like circa 2010, where he said, yeah, we'll normalize the balance sheet by 2000. I think it was 2015. No problem, right? Just, oh yeah, we'll normalize the balance sheet. You know, and here we are now, which is, what are we, more than two times what's on the balance sheet now compared to then, or something like that.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, I've written about this before a long time ago. It reminds me of an old joke I heard when I was a kid. Now, bear in mind, I grew up in the 1970s when jokes didn't have to be politically correct. So I'm going to tell this joke as I heard it. The butt of the joke is an Irish person. I apologize to any Irish people out there who are offended by this. It's just a joke. Please don't write to me. But this is how I heard it in the 70s, about the Irish guy on a plane, and they're flying to Dublin, and the pilot comes over the loudspeaker and says, ladies and gentlemen, I'm terribly sorry to inform you, but one of our engines has flamed out, so we will be approximately 30 minutes late arriving into Dublin. And they carry on, and about half an hour later, the pilot comes across and says, ladies and gentlemen, I'm terribly sorry, but we've lost another of our four engines, so we're probably going to be an hour late arriving into Dublin. A little while further along, the third engine goes, and the captain comes over and warns everybody that they're going to be 90 minutes late into Dublin. And then shortly before they're about to land, the fourth engine finally gives out, and the Irish guy sitting in row 27 says, ah, geez, we're going to be up here forever now. and that's kind of where we are with all this stuff, right? We keep doing this, and we're going down that road, and everything's going to go up forever. But at some point, you know, that fourth engine is going to flame out, and this stuff is going to matter, and people are not going to want to own U.S. sovereign debt and pay, you know, and be paid 0.3% for it, or be paid, you know, 2% for 30 years, given the state of the country's finances. And that is going to be the same in the UK. It's going to be the same in Europe. It's going to be the same in just about every country on earth. You know, in Europe at the moment, we have the ECB buying 85% of sovereign issuance in the last year, and 100% of the southern nation's issuance. Now, if you think that can go on forever, you're out of your mind. It just doesn't work. Why are they doing it? Because if they didn't do it, the prices will be lower, the yields will be higher, and it would cause problems. So they didn't buy those bonds because they wanted them. They bought 85% of European sovereign issuance because they had to. Because if they hadn't bought them, there was no one else to buy them at those prices. So that's where we're going. We're already well down that path. And unfortunately, if that fourth engine does go out, we will not be up here forever.
Yeah, much to the surprise of a lot of newly minted Wall Street Bets millionaires, right? one of the things that I've been working, just as a side note, I kind of say this almost just to put a bug in your ear, hoping that you look into it and hoping you think about it from this perspective, because you know, I think you probably have much deeper research chops than I do, and you're great at writing about these kinds of things. But one of the things that I keep seeing over and over, it's something that I'm working on that I'm referring to as the tail wagging the dog. Everywhere I look, you just said the Fed, right? The Fed has started down this path, and now they're being pulled down the path, right? I see that as the tail wagging the dog. I think that what we have seen, you know, for your entire career and much shorter career to this point, my entire career, options are derivatives, right? They move because of the underlying stock moving. Well, now we've seen, you know, the inflow into the option side so big that you have the options markets moving the underlying. I feel like we, you know, go look at the so much of the stuff happening socially in the political world. It just seems like everywhere I look, I see this phenomenon of the tail wagging the dog. And I'm fascinated, Grant, by the interlude or the interchange and the meeting point, if you will, or the intersection point of finance and then society in general. right? Because there's so much there's so much in common, right? They feed into each other so much, and probably never more than it does today, just because of the interconnectivity of the world and free trading platforms on people's phones. And I say it to plant a bug and seeing if you've noticed that, because I don't know what conclusions to draw. I also don't know that if I think that that's a new phenomenon because it's the first time I've noticed it. But I just, everywhere I look, it just seems like everything has been flipped on its ear, that the tail is wagging the dog. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I think you're right in many places. Sometimes it's short term, sometimes it's more kind of pervasive and it creeps in. But I think the social media aspect of this is it's impossible to overestimate, in my opinion. You know, we started off this conversation talking about my decision to change my business the way I did, and the reasons behind that were kind of crafted out of the very phenomenon you're talking about, where it's important to have a big audience, because with a big audience you have presence, you have credibility, you have all these things that a big audience gives you. And the truth of that is just not the case. You know, just because you have a big audience, that doesn't make you credible. It doesn't make what you do credible. You may have just hit a nerve, you may have been part of a meme, whatever it may be. There are all kinds of reasons these days why people end up with a big audience. And sometimes it can happen very, very quickly. Now, in some cases, it's because people do outstanding work and what they do resonates with an awful lot of people at the same time. And it's possible to build a big audience quickly in this day and age. But to build a big, engaged audience in this way that is there because you're credible, you're reliable, is not so easy. And yet, to me, the ultimate tail wagging the dog is this idea that size is everything, and size does matter. You know, we know that's not the case. But this idea that if someone has a blue check mark, they should be someone you listen to. It's the tail wagging the dog, as you say, right? It's not difficult to get a blue check mark, right? I mean, yes, there are hurdles you have to jump through, but people think it bestows upon you all kinds of things that it absolutely doesn't. It's the same in the world of media. If someone's on TV, they must be credible, because how do they get on TV if they're not credible? And you know, having been exposed to that world myself, I was shocked to find out how the whole thing really works, about how many people end up on TV and how a lot of platforms source the people they want to go and put in front of the public on a given subject.
Yeah, they pay for it.
Yeah, that to me, yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. I mean, in the early days of Real Vision, I was amazed when I would ring up people I wanted to talk to and they would say, yeah, we'd love to do this. How much is it going to cost us? And me being, the gormless neophyte that I was at the time, was like, what do you mean? What do you mean? You paid to go on TV? And so, that for me is a deeply personal realization, and I completely agree with you. You know, I'm using one example, but wherever you look, I think the tail is wagging the dog, because as Andre Agassi said back in the 80s, image is everything, and creating an image is the ultimate tail, right? And if you create the right image, and you're smart about it, and you are kind of Machiavellian about it, it's not that difficult a thing to do these days. And I think that's a great shame. I really do.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, I don't at all put myself in the, not even like a feeder league to the minor leagues of the iconoclast investors. So in no way am I saying this, but I built a nice business for myself, and we manage over $200 million and I get to live a dream every single day. I get to do what I love. I'm my own boss, and I watch so many of these young people doing that, constructing, you know, approaching it from that level, right? Because that's what they see all the time. I'm dealing with young family members that are trying to do the same thing. And I always give them the same guidance, which is, you know, go counterculture, right? You go about things that way, you're effectively constructing a Potemkin career, right? You're building this false facade, and it's only a matter of time until it falls and or gets blown over or whatever the case may be. Don't waste your time for that short hit, right? Dig in and do the work, because that will always work out. Where, you know, we only look at the success stories, right, from there. And people, you know, the vast majority of these quote unquote Potemkin careers that these people, they're going to go the way of the dinosaur, the way they always do, right? It's no different than it's ever been.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's wise advice.
I think it's just sad. Okay, so one last thing, and I just want to put this, what do you think, when we look at the, you know, because the market as a whole, especially, you know, the large cap and large cap tech and FANGs, we everybody knows that. There is an incredible amount of overvalue, you know, excessive valuation, obscene valuation. And yet, you know, coming out from it, I run a value fund. And when you're willing to look in some of those places in the market that have been completely ignored, there is still a lot of value. What do you think the possibilities of this resolving itself by way of not a massive crash, but, you know, a massive rotation, right? And for those listening, I'm not speaking my book. you know, that would be wonderful for our value portfolio, but, you know, that's not the only way that we invest with people. And I'm really not trying to look at this from the self-serving side of it. But more from the side of it, if you look at the construct of the world today, what are we at? $18 to $19 trillion of negatively trading sovereign debt. You know, the Fed may be able to control liquidity conditions. I don't think they're going to have nearly as much success controlling solvency conditions. Right. And you look at all the things that have been left for dead, like Altria, for instance. Altria's stock, you got a bulletproof business model. And it's throwing out a 7.9% dividend. I do not own Altria. I may at some point in the relatively near future. I'm kind of wrestling with myself on some of that. But I look at these companies that in this environment with 0% rates and insolvency and negative cash flowing companies, I feel like what people should be buying is that stuff. I think of how at some point, if you disagree, you know, I'd love to hear your take on it, which is why I want to pose the question to you. But I look at an Altria or you know, and I'm using that as the example. There's so many like that. But when I look at the conditions that we're facing as a world, 0% rates, you know, all those other things that we all know, it seems to me that it's only a matter of time until those companies are going to get bid through the roof because people need income, right? And I'm wondering if the culmination of this wouldn't be a serious, if not massive, correction in a lot of that overpriced stuff. But watching that fervor, watching that overpriced mania actually flow into some of those names, because there's actual utility there, right? And I would love, if you disagree, I'd love to hear why. And if you do disagree, but you know, in this current setup, I look at a stock like Altria and think to myself, good golly, that's gonna come in awful handy to a lot of people, right?
Yeah, look, I think this brings us back to a previous point about the meme and the narrative, right? It's tough to create any kind of appealing narrative / meme around something like Altria. Yes, it offers great value, but where's your story? And so if we get this great rotation, and we always do, ultimately, that's how the market clears, we get a rotation. I think the problem this time is that so many people are herded into so few stocks. And you know, that's why at the end of these crazy bull runs, you see one of the big signs to be very, very cautious is the narrowing leadership. And that's what we're seeing now. You know, we're seeing an incredibly narrow leadership of the stock market higher. But what happens when you get to that rotation point is there are too many people trying to get out of those kind of previously darling stocks. And yes, while the smart investors are putting it into the Altrias of the world and companies of their ilk, most of them are just trying to head for the exit and get out. They're not really thinking about that. So generally speaking, you get the turn, you get the narrow leadership starting to get sold. And in this case, it's going to be the FANG stocks. I mean, that's where everybody's herded. You'll start seeing those fall. And whilst the pros are going to be trying to rotate into other assets and into other companies, into other sectors, and you will see the commodity sector, you'll see the gold miner sector, you'll see the, you know, individual companies like Altria with that offer a good, sensible, sound harbour for capital in times like this. You will see those getting bid up. But will you see them go crazy? I doubt it very much. I think over time they'll perform very well because we will enter a new phase of the market where it is value that's important because so many people will have been burned by momentum that they will have a solid bid under them and they will start to climb. I don't think you'll see the kind of performance we've seen in the momentum stocks, but that's the nature of the beast. But they will have their day, and I would argue that the dramatic swing from active to passive, from value to growth, it has been so violent that the swing back the other way is likely ultimately to be equally violent if a little gentler, if that makes sense. It's not going to happen as quickly, but it'll go just as far in the other direction where nobody wants to touch momentum and everybody's all about value. And for me personally, that day can't come soon enough, and I'm sure you agree.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you just think, again, it's just really hard for me to envision a time in the not-so-distant future where if you've built a portfolio that's throwing off, you know, a 7 to 7.5% yield overall, that's not going to be unbelievably valuable. As you know, where else do you get income these days? And you know, inflation protection. You know, again, tale as old as time, right? You get to the top of these bubbles, and people are buying what they wished they would have bought, and they're selling what they're about ready to need, right? And then again, tale as old as time, I suppose. Well, hey, Grant, I can't thank you enough for taking this much time with us. It's always great to catch up with you, and really appreciate you coming on. For the listeners out there, I cannot highly recommend your podcast enough. And I'm excited to see what you do from it here. That's why I wanted to get on the bandwagon and come along for the ride. And for people that want to subscribe, they can go to grant-williams.com. Super easy to sign up. Get all the great podcast info, and they can also follow you on Twitter at TTMYGH. Did I say that right?
You got it. That's exactly right. You saved me doing it. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem, pal. I do what we can. So anyway, thanks for coming on. Blast to talk to you, and we'll be watching closely about how this thing goes and looking for the gold and platinum rollout membership levels, because I'm very curious to see what those are, and you know, because I have a feeling I will be upgrading. So anyway, yeah, just thanks for doing it, Grant. It's just been a pleasure as always.
I've enjoyed every time we've had a chance to speak. Anytime you want me back, I'd love to do it. It's a really, really fun time. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Pleasure's all mine, sir. Anyway, all right, you guys. Well, hey, thank you for joining us today. And as always, we'll be back next week. Have another interview lined up for you. So until then, take care of yourselves. And you're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. You can download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.